Dina Ahmadu. Welcome to Health Chat. Have you ever lost someone or something that was important to you? If the answer is yes, you most likely have experienced grief afterwards. The COVID-19 pandemic this year has caused people to grieve individually or collectively around the world, as many people have lost loved ones, social connections, sense of safety, or financial security. On the show today, we will look at grief. The medical journal Psychology Today explains grief as the acute pain that accompanies loss, resulting to a variety of emotions like sadness, loneliness, confusion, and sometimes guilt. According to experts, there is no right or wrong way to grieve. Nonetheless, there are healthy ways to overcome it. To find out more about grieving, I spoke with David Kessler, founder of Grief.com and author of the book Finding Meaning. Take a listen. David Kessler, thank you so much for joining us today.
I'm so glad to be with you.
It's great to have you. You are the founder of Grief.com, a website, and also author of Finding Meaning, a new book that was released not long ago. First and foremost, talk to us about grief. How would you describe grief?
So grief is a change we do not want. So when a loved one dies, that's a change we don't want. When there's a pandemic, when a wedding is canceled, when a loved one dies, a pet dies, we're all stuck at home. Those are all losses and changes that we don't want.
So you described different situations from the loss of a loved one to a pet to an event. Are there different types of grief then?
Yes, I talk about them as macro and micro. In other words, big losses and small ones. And obviously the biggest loss is a loved one dying, but we also have a marriage ending is a loss, a job ending is a loss, your pet dying is a loss, a wedding canceled, all those things are losses.
There is pain involved in grief, in grieving.
Yes.
And talk to us about that pain, which is a natural occurrence when you lose someone or something that is so important. How do we process that?
The pain of grief is natural, and grieving is an organic process. It's interesting. I always tell people, you come from a long line of dead people. Every ancestor you've ever had has died. Your soul, your psyche, your body knows how to do this. It's our society that tells us we're doing it wrong when society says, move on, or you only got a month, or you only got 3 days off work, or you should be forgetting about it after a year. All of those things aren't true, and sometimes they actually complicate our grief.
Is there a time frame for the grief to end, or does it depend on each individual?
That's such a good question. There's no timeline in grief. So we have different, you know, we have what we call anticipatory grief, is the grief that happens before a death. Then afterwards, I think of early grief as the first 2 years of grief. But when someone says to me, how long is my wife or my husband or my brother or sister going to grieve? I'll sometimes say, how long is the person going to be dead? Because if they're going to be dead for a long time, you're going to grieve for a long time. But that doesn't mean you will always grieve with pain. My goal in working with people is that we grieve with more love than pain eventually, but we do have to deal with the pain first.
So talk to us about the different stages of grief. You say we grieve with more love than pain eventually. That's your goal. In the beginning, it's all about pain. At least for me, I lost my dad not long ago, this August actually, and it's pain, you know. So at
right.
What point does the pain shifts to being focusing on love?
First of all, can you tell me your dad's first name?
Pascal.
Pascal. Yes, thank you. Because I never like to talk about someone as a loss. He's not a loss. He's your dad, Pascal. And we need to make sure we remember that. So, of course, it's going to be pain. And pain is part of the love. In fact, the pain is related to the love. The more intense your love, the more intense the pain you're going to have. So that's how that works. So if you're in a lot of pain, it means there's a lot of love there. So as we talk about the stages, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross first identified the five stages of grief, of dying, in her book On Death and Dying in 1969. Then I was really honored to work with her in this book on grief and grieving, where we adapted her stages from dying to grief. And literally, when you look in this book, on the first page, it says the stages are denial, anger, bargaining, depression, acceptance. And they are not linear. They're not a map for grief. They're not over, they are overlapping. You can't do this wrong. And there's no one model for grief. So the criticisms you'll often hear is that it's not linear, it's not a map, she never adapted them. And it's like, no, we did adapt them. And we have all the criticism laid out on page one that you're right, they're not true. They're very organic. And you don't have to follow them. You don't have to know about them.
When we don't know the specific stages of grief, how do we process the grief?
So you do not have to know the stages. The stages, you know, people think we follow the stages, but the stages really reflect where we are. Kubler-Ross identified what people are feeling, but she never told people what to feel. So denial is the disbelief. I can't believe this is happening. We have anger. Maybe we get angry that they died. Now, not everyone goes through anger. Some people do, some people don't. There's bargaining. Bargaining is all the what ifs, if onlys, the guilt. All of us would have done the last day, the last week, the last year differently had we known exactly when our loved one was going to die. Then we have depression, which is often the sadness that we feel, and we experience acceptance. And acceptance doesn't mean you like the loss or you're okay with the loss. Acceptance just means you acknowledge the reality. Now, one of the things that happened with Elizabeth and I is over the years, acceptance took on a finality, like when you accept that they've died, you're sort of done grieving. And that's not true. A few years ago, after being a grief expert for decades, and I went into this work after my mother died when I was 13 and there was a mass shooting, I spent all these years writing books, doing work with people in grief, and then my younger son, David, died 4 years ago. And it was brutal as you could imagine. I saw myself going through the different stages, and when I got to acceptance, and I thought, and by the way, my days maybe would look like yours. In 1 hour, I would go, I can't believe he's gone. I'm angry he's gone. I don't want to accept he's gone, and I'm sad. I could do all the stages in 1 hour. They didn't have to be linear, right? So when I started wrestling with acceptance after about a year, I said, acceptance can't be enough. I can't just end there. I want to find meaning. So that's when I wrote this new book, which is Finding Meaning, The Sixth Stage of Grief. And when I wrote that book, I was so honored that the Elizabeth Kubler-Ross family and foundation gave me permission to add a sixth stage, because I think we're a generation that we don't just want to stop at acceptance. We want more. We want to find meaning. Now, a couple of things about meaning, and then I'll ask you about this with your dad. Meaning doesn't mean that there's meaning in the death. There's no meaning in the way someone died or a horrible pandemic. Meaning is in us afterwards. Maybe, for example, you're changed by just having that amazing dad. You know, people often say, when my loved one died, a part of me died with him, but a part of them lives on in you. I bet a part of your dad lives on in you. That probably brings you meaning. And meaning doesn't take away the pain, but it adds a little cushion.
Thank you so much. So at what point is there closure, or is there such a thing as closure when we talk about grief?
There is no closure. There is no day we close that door on grief. My mother died over 45 years ago. I'm not forgetting her. I'm not recovering from her. She wasn't a cold. She was my mother. I'm never getting over her. I'm always going to have a sweet spot in my heart for her. So I don't think there's closure. I think there's peace that we find. And our loved ones want us to find closure, which means they want us to find peace.
Because sometimes people talk about closure, and I'm so glad you said that. Is there a difference between grieving and mourning?
Grieving is what's inside of us. Mourning is what we do on the outside. So I can't ever look at someone and go, she's at home crying more than she is. She's grieving more. No, I can see your acts of mourning, but I can't see who's grieving the most. I can't look in you. So no one can see our grief. Like many times, I'm sure you've said to people, they say, how are you? And you go, you fine? You're not really fine, but they can't see inside. So you say to the clerk at the grocery store, I'm fine, thank you. It wasn't a moment that deserved your grief, but you can say you're fine and get away with it when you're really not.
Then my other question is there a difference in this, in grieving, when you see the lost coming? What I mean by that is, let's say you have someone who is very ill, and you know the person eventually will die, but then you have someone who dies suddenly. What sorts of difference are there in terms of processing and everything?
Good question. So there's a few things about that. When we talk about anticipatory grief, we all know that someday our parents are going to die. And slowly we're trying to get ready. So that's what anticipatory grief looks like. If someone dies out of the blue, they were fine, they weren't sick, that sudden death can be a little more complicated and more harder. How do you deal with here for breakfast, gone for lunch? That's a challenging thing to deal with. But I also caution people, sometimes we have what's called a sudden death in an expected death. Maybe your loved one was 80 and they died suddenly. And everyone around you goes, well, they were 80 or they were 90, so you kind of knew it was coming. But you didn't know it was coming that day. Or someone with an illness gets told, you've got 5 years, but then they die at 1 year. It still feels sudden because you weren't expecting it.
So finally, what sort of advice would you give first to someone who's grieving, and then second to people who are with someone who is grieving? Because sometimes you hear, oh, get over it, stop crying, you know, things like that. So just what sort of advice would you give to the people who are supporting those who are grieving, and then for the people who are grieving, what do you have to say?
Sure. Great questions there. So first of all, for you yourself, if you're the griever, to know you're doing it right, you can't do it wrong, and you don't need anyone's permission to grieve your way. If everyone around you wants you to get over it, oh, well, that's their uncomfortableness. Sometimes people will go, oh, we want the old you back. And I'll go, I would want the old me back. I'd want my loved ones alive. But the old me is changed now because of this death. So to those supporting people, I would say, if you have a friend or a loved one who's grieving, they don't need to be fixed, because they're not broken. What they need from you is for you to witness their grief, to say, you know what? I see you're in pain. I can't fix it or make it better, but I can sit here with you. And I want you to know, as hard as this is, you're not going to do this alone, and I'm here with you. You just witness their grief. You don't try to fix them. And by the way, you mentioned early on, grief.com is my website. I have a free group there for anyone who's had a death that they can come on, and it's a free group for support. I have lots of resources at grief.com for anyone who's struggling or having a hard time after they've had a death.
And your book, is it available on the website as well?
Absolutely. And at all bookstores online, and now in person, bookstores are back opening, and it's Finding Meaning, the Sixth Stage of Grief.
David Kessler, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. So glad to be with you.
That was David Kessler, founder of grief.com and author of the book Finding Meaning. Well, it is time for a short break. When we return, we'll take a look at the COVID-19 pandemic. Don't go away. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Health Chat. Now to Nigeria. Authorities there are worried that coronavirus infections may spike again as millions ignore safety measures such as wearing face masks and social distancing. A jump in infections could force another lockdown, hurting the economy, as Timoteo Biezu reports from Abuja.
45-year-old Nigerian butcher Martin Olaya strongly strikes the blades of his cutting knives against the other in order to attract the attention of customers. It's been months since the coronavirus pandemic lockdown was lifted, and this Utako market in Abuja is again operating at full capacity. But among many concerns of business owners like Olaya, the coronavirus pandemic is the least of them. Market is really bad. We don't know what the coronavirus is. We haven't seen it. There's nothing that concerns Nigeria with that. God will not allow it. Many traders like Olaya continue to doubt the coronavirus ever existed and therefore are flouting safety rules. Abuja resident Dorothy Wozo, who's shopping for groceries, is one of very few people wearing a face mask. She says she's not happy that others are not taking responsibility.
Look around you. You can count the number of people wearing face masks. People are touching meat. People are touching foodstuff. They don't sanitize their hands.
Nigeria has recorded more than 67,400 cases of the coronavirus since its first one in February. The Nigeria Center for Disease Control says the country reached its peak infections between July and August and then recorded a downward trend. But officials say coronavirus infections began rising again in November as many countries began battling a second wave of the infection. Chinwe Achu, a director of the NCDC, worries that citizens, especially younger people, have stopped being vigilant.
Above 21 years and less than 50 years are more likely not to adhere to COVID-19 prevention protocols because they are usually the ones that don't have the severe symptoms. But these are the people that are likely to have the disease and transmit it to the vulnerable elderly groups or people with comorbidities who could die from it.
COVID-19 is the disease caused by the coronavirus. Experts attribute the new rise in cases to the End-SARS protests last month, which saw thousands of young Nigerians march against police brutality. The use and sales of personal protective equipment have also dropped significantly. Nigerian authorities are trying to avoid imposing strict lockdowns by urging citizens to adhere to COVID-19 guidelines. President Muhammadu Buhari has warned the country's already fragile economy may not withstand another lockdown. Economics lecturer Anas Ibrahim agrees with the president.
About 60 to 65% of the sectors that we have in Nigeria now, they actually decline. They are not performing. They are not actually, you know, lucrative to actually to boost the economy in order to create more job opportunities, a lot of revenue to the government.
Last week, Nigeria's Bureau of Statistics announced the country had plunged into a recession after its economy contracted by 3.6% due to coronavirus disruptions. Authorities say they are hopeful that the economy will begin to recover early next year, but that citizens must act responsibly. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja.
South Africa's president has announced new anti-coronavirus measures in a major city as the nation nervously watches an increase in confirmed cases. Cyril Ramaphosa pleaded with South Africans to comply with all restrictions to keep the virus from spreading during the holiday season. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
This has been a tough year for the nation with Africa's highest coronavirus burden, President Cyril Ramaphosa acknowledged. But now, as many South Africans plan to embark on a month-long summer holiday, now is not the time for South Africa to let down its guard, the president warned in a Thursday night speech. This week, President Ramaphosa announced a set of restrictions targeted at the nation's current coronavirus hotspot, Nelson Mandela Bay, also known as Port Elizabeth. He warned that the entire country could be next.
As much as we want to relax, this virus does not relax. And this virus does not take a holiday. This 2020 has been a difficult year for us as a nation and as a country. It has severely tested our resolve and demanded great sacrifices of each and every one of us. But even as the holidays approach, we cannot let our guard down.
Nearly 22,000 South Africans have already died, he noted. Port Elizabeth has recently seen a jump in confirmed cases. The city's 1 million residents must now observe a nighttime curfew and are restricted in both buying and consuming alcohol in public. Gatherings are now limited to 250 people for outdoor events and 100 for indoor events. The president also said that nationwide, post-funeral gatherings are prohibited. Johannesburg, the nation's economic hub, is known for drawing people from around the country. During the end-of-year holidays, the city empties out as many residents return to their families. Security guard Eric Cabello says he plans to return to Carletonville, a small town southwest of Johannesburg, for the season. Cabello, who is 27, says he has no quibble with the restrictions.
Yeah, I think it's fine. Because of alcohol, it gives us a problem. You can see, you can check even a lot of people, they get to accidents. You see, a lot of things are happening. Alcohol, I think the restriction is better.
Office manager Tando Zondi is also hoping to travel this holiday season to her home in the KwaZulu-Natal province. No restrictions have been announced for that area, she said.
His speech yesterday was mostly for PE, and I'm in Gauteng, so I'm not really affected. We're still on level one? Yeah, still on level one, so didn't change anything for us, so I'm not affected. I'm fine.
However, in his half-hour televised family meeting, President Ramaphosa reminded all South Africans they have a role to play in keeping the resurgence contained.
Fellow South Africans, we must change our behavior now to prevent a resurgence of the virus and manage outbreaks wherever they occur. If we think of this pandemic like a bushfire, we need to quickly extinguish the flare-ups, the flames, before they turn into a big wildfire like an inferno.
Serious words as the nation approaches its first break in a difficult year. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Still in South Africa, some civil society groups are calling on the government to reintroduce alcohol bans as COVID-19 infections and deaths spike around the country. With about 815,000 infections and more than 22,000 deaths, South Africa is the epicenter of the pandemic on the continent and the 16th most affected nation globally. Darren Taylor has more from Johannesburg.
The festive season is approaching fast, and for many, it's a time to celebrate and drink alcohol. But officials in South Africa fear this could result in an increase of alcohol-related hospitalizations, including from violence and car crashes. During the pandemic, that means less hospital beds for COVID-19 patients. The government recently announced tighter regulation of alcohol sales in some coronavirus hotspots. But Maurice Smithers of the Southern African Alcohol Policy Alliance says this isn't enough and restrictions should be tighter, especially around Christmas and the New Year.
All on-consumption outlets should close at 6 p.m. That means that people cannot go into the night drinking, especially in the late hours of the night. That is the time that the most damage is likely to be done.
Smithers says recent police raids have shown that many bars and taverns haven't even got hand sanitizers on premises and are showing flagrant disregard for people's health.
It's better that they don't drink in on consumption outlets and rather drink at home, where they can continue to celebrate with their families and people who are close to them, but not in these large super spreader events.
South African Liquor Brand Owners Association chairperson Sibani Mngadi agrees that some bar owners aren't complying with safety measures. So he says his group is taking action to make sure the defiance stops.
We have provided 30 million rand for procurement of health supplies. We are also providing, particularly for those districts, the team of patrollers who are going to help police to ensure compliance amongst traders in those specific problematic areas. And I think
Ngadi says reintroducing the kinds of alcohol restrictions seen at the beginning of the pandemic will be a final nail in his industry's and the South African economy's coffin.
We need to balance the economic interest, which is protection of the million jobs that are supported by this industry, the income that comes in terms of business activity, as well as excise tax that we contribute. We contribute something like 57 billion in various taxes to the fiscal. So there is that element that we need to protect. At the same time, we are very conscious that we are facing a serious, serious health problem that we need to contain. All of us cannot afford a national resurgence of cases, as well as the pressure on the health system.
Smithers says South Africans, like many others around the world, are forgetting that we're still in the middle of one of the biggest health crises in history. In that context, he maintains, we cannot live as we once did, and we certainly cannot drink alcohol like we used to.
It's very important for people to realize that if we don't sacrifice now, if we don't forego some of the normal ways in which we celebrate over the festive season now, some of us may not be around at the end of 2021 for that festive season. They're saying that the IC units in all the private hospitals around Durban are full. So there is a serious problem happening, and our concern is that what government is doing at the moment, it's being reactive, not proactive.
Reintroduce more stringent alcohol restrictions now, says Smithers, not after parties attended by hundreds of people spark thousands more infections. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Finally, more than 40,000 people have fled Tigray over the 4 weeks of fighting, most of them going to Sudan. The United Nations has warned that their situation is precarious as camps become crowded. And Naba Mohedin reports from Al-Kharif, Sudan, that the refugees face a new threat, a COVID-19 outbreak.
Thousands of Ethiopians who fled fighting in Tigray to camps in Sudan are facing a new threat, a COVID-19 outbreak. There are no confirmed cases, but concern is running high, as Naba Muhideen reports from Al-Kadarif, Sudan.
Over the past month, more than 40,000 Ethiopians have fled clashes in Tigray to camps in eastern Sudan.
Those arriving are placed in three camps in the cities of Gadarif and Kassala. 32-year-old Isfai Ali and his pregnant wife fled Humara to get away from the fighting, but now face a possible COVID-19 outbreak in one of the camps. He says in Humara some cases of coronavirus were discovered, but the government controlled it. Because of the internal conflict, he fled to Sudan. Yet he's so worried about the spread of COVID-19 here in the camp due to the living standards, rooms and shortage of the water. Social distancing is difficult in the camps, where at least six refugees stay in each small tent or room. People are gathered in large groups to get food, water or blankets, without enough water or soap. Health workers warn refugees of the coronavirus risk and teach them methods to prevent the spread of the virus. Isolation centers are also being built. Yusuf says high population and the big number of refugees represent a risk factor for the spread of the virus. There is a possibility some suspected cases fled isolation centers in the war zone and came to the camps. A second wave of COVID-19 is sweeping across Sudan, which reports at least 17,000 registered cases and a high mortality rate. The government has shut down universities and schools and is considering whether to impose more restrictions. The UN Refugee Agency is calling for more international aid to deal with the crisis. Refugees are trying to adjust, constructing small markets inside the camps and close to hosting villages. Meanwhile, the Sudanese government is setting up a new refugee camp 250 kilometers from Khartoum to help ease overcrowding in the existing camps. Naba Muhideen for VUA News, Umbrakuba Refugee Camp, Al-Kadarif.
That's it for this edition of Health Chat. For the latest news and coverage on the coronavirus pandemic, visit voanews.com. Check us out at facebook.com/VOA Health Chat and let's keep the conversation going. Thank you all for joining us, and special thanks to all our affiliate stations throughout Africa for carrying Health Chat. I'm your host, Lenore Mudo, in Washington, with producer Dan Brown.